Hi, everybody. This is CJ Wilson with Josh Olsiewicz, and we have a very special guest today on the Bitcoin Bottom Line. We're going to be talking with Troy Cross, who is a very wise man in the realm of Bitcoin, not only because he has a philosophy background, but because he engages with people on all ends of the spectrum on Bitcoin Twitter. Sometimes I feel like, Troy, I see these tornadoes you're involved in, and it just seems like there's just this part of your nature is you're so curious, you keep pulling on strings. How many times have you been, like, I guess, embroiled in or tied up with these strings that you're pulling on?
Yeah, it happens. And every time you learn something, you know, I'm curious. I'm not afraid to be wrong. I'm an academic philosopher. That's my background. I teach metaphysics and epistemology. I'm a Bitcoiner since 2011. I started mining back then. I'm also, as I say in my tagline, an environmentalist. That triggers some people. Some people like it. It means different things to different people. I think for Bitcoiners, the translation is I aim to have a very, very low time preference with respect to the environment. And I'm not afraid of controversy, although I've been stung by it more than once. And I appreciate the Bitcoin communities taking me seriously, having conversations with me, taking me not seriously, making memes about me, whatever. I'm really grateful for the engagement. This is part of what drew me to Bitcoin back in 2011. The community back then, Bitcoin Talk Forums, was a refreshingly different place to be than, the elite universities and colleges where I was teaching, which have their own charm and their own advantages. But Bitcoin Talk Forum was cool. It was, I didn't have any edge there because of my credentials. There was no hierarchy there. People were proving work by saying interesting things that helped other people get farther with their own thoughts. And I tried to do the same back then, not very well. And I'm still trying. I'm a pleb who just weighs in on a ton of stuff, professional reply guy, a fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. I really, really appreciate you having me on. We've had some interesting conversations, CJ. I've been watching your work for a long time, admiring what you do for the community, representing us to people outside the community, but also, you know, appreciate your thoughts inside the community, both ways. So it's a real honor. Thank you for having me on.
And let me add, by the way, you know, you and I are both, we're both professors. At the end of the day, you may be a tenured professor at Reed University, right? Now, I was a professor in a biotechnology lab, adjunct professor at Hopkins. So what I'm trying to say is, CJ, you have to call us both professor. it's like the president or governor. If you're
all right,
you're forever.
So professor, you prefer to be professor with the first initial or the last initial is the question, I guess. So you be Professor J or Professor O? That's the one.
Some people thought I looked like Spider-Man, but anyway, we won't go there.
So this is something that I want to bring up, though, okay? Because Troy, this is something that I feel like I share with you, which is a broad vision concept. And this is something that a lot of people in Bitcoin tend to not have, right? Because a lot of people have only found success in Bitcoin and they haven't found it in other places yet. The people that are, I would say, that the heroes of Bitcoin, so to speak, right? The big cultural thing of Bitcoin is that nobody is safe from criticism, right? We see that with people that we've had on this show, people that you've been on their shows, and people that are followed by hundreds of thousands or millions of Bitcoiners. So yeah. I guess the question is, right, thick skin is a requisite to be a voice in the space, right? It's also important to be, you know, to listen and to take other people's opinions, especially like antagonistically, to say, okay, like we might be close on a subject, right? Very close, but that sort of Overton window or the ZOPA, as I learned in like my negotiations class, the zone of possible agreement, that's going to shift a little bit depending on which end of the Bitcoin octopus we're talking about, right? So the one I want to get into first is the environmental aspect, which, because that is something that triggers people really hard, right? And you have people that I really admire, that I really like, that say things like ESG is a scam. And then you say things like, hey, listen, this is why they're trying to do ESG. The people that have good faith with ESG, this is why they're trying to do it. And I think like you take this fresh approach and you like wave a flag and you're like, before anybody shoots, please, please just can we just sit down and like fold our hands on the table for a second? And I think you do such a great job of that. I don't know how you do it. Because
thank you. And
you stand up to the steamroller constantly and somehow you reemerge like a cartoon character, like unfazed, dusted off, everything's fine. You know,
well, I don't know that I actually succeed in doing that, but it's, I mean, that's about being a philosopher, right? You have to kind of wade into a mess of ideas and try to separate out the good and the bad. So if we're going to say something like ESG, yeah, those words are very triggering for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And they're triggering for a good reason. It's because, you know, like people hate Bitcoin and they see it as an attack on them. And ESG is a convenient way they can attack it. It's not that they're actually concerned about the environment. It's like they're threatened by losing power. So they use this. And more broadly, ESG is a scam. I would say that's true. It is a scam. A lot of ESG rhetoric is actually advertising for Wall Street firms who want to package up the same old equities and sell them to you for a premium because they're ESG. You can see that by just looking at the companies that are on the ESG list. They're among the most polluting and worst.
Yeah, right? It's like Philip Morris and stuff like that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. ESG means nothing when you it really means nothing. It's just the largest companies. What it means is that you have hired a team of people to document how you behave as a corporation with respect to a set of metrics, which are given to you by a Wall Street firm. You have hired a team of people to help you do that and document how you are improving along those metric lines. And of course, you'll have a say in how those metrics are exactly put together and how they are applied. But the firms that have a lot of excess capital to do that, they're the ones that will end up featured best in the list. You know, Elon Musk made a point of this, that Tesla wasn't on the list while he's electrifying transport. But, you know, major oil companies are on the list. He was like, this is a head scratcher. What does it really mean? And so, like, I agree with all that. And furthermore, so ESG is an attack vector on Bitcoin, ESG as a scam designed to enrich Wall Street firms by simply repackaging existing economic activity. ESG as a tool for exploiting and distorting market forces. I think all of those criticisms are perfectly legitimate. And I that's like making a distinction. Like, yeah, that's all right. I agree with all that. On the other hand, if you want to invest in ways that are good for humanity, as you see that good, good for the planet, as you see that good, that's called a free market. That's a free market in investing your money.
Right.
And if you want to say like, hey, I've got my retirement, I don't want it going towards, let's say, extracting oil in Nigeria and not rewarding Nigerians for it. I don't want that to happen on my watch with my money in my name. It's your right not to give your money to that kind of an operation, right? That's just free market.
So the question I have on that though, because I feel like one thing that Bitcoiners are so good at is picking things apart, right? And by picking things apart, you sort through the thread and you try to find the nugget of truth, the signal with all the noise, if you will, right? So it's sort of like looking for a white needle in a haystack of black needles, right? Like you're looking for the thing that actually counts. I mean, that's sort of the way the block reward works and things like that. It's a lot of antagonistic searching or digging or, you know, through people's work. So as a, like, I would say environmentally conscious person growing up as a surfer, you know, I see people when they talk about ESG and I understand the E, in the sense that the environment is actually important, right? Because I like to go surf, I like clean water. And to me, I equate everything with clean water because clean water is like the building block for like all of these things. clean water is the most important building block that we need as humans, really. We see that when there's not clean water in certain places, that's a big problem. We talked about something at Pacific Bitcoin that literally blew my mind. And it was in relation to the fact that Bitcoin has these environmental properties that people are starting to learn how to, these secondary effects of Bitcoin mining. But this is now we're seeing like things split so far, and now they're kind of coming back together again on that angle. So that's something that you're getting involved in.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to wrap up our bit on ESG, I think ESG is a scam as it is implemented, and the critics of ESG should be listened to. I think people should be able to invest in accordance with their values as they see it. We have different opinions about how the environment is affected by economic activity, and you should be able to invest in ways that reflect your opinions about those effects. Now, when it comes to Bitcoin specifically, there's also the case to be made that it is very ESG appropriate investment. On the governance, of course, it's just obvious. This is a protocol that the governance couldn't be any more fair, open, and distributed than deciding what to run on your own extremely low cost node, and how to participate in an open network running on software, every line of which can be inspected. And on the social side, of course, I won't belabor this. We know that Bitcoin gives financial access to anyone in the world with an internet connection and treats everyone the same. Like, you can't ask for a more socially positive tool, socially positive and fair financial tool than Bitcoin. So it maxes out the S and the G score on any reasonable system of scoring. On the E side, of course, Bitcoin is under tremendous fire from the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the Biden administration, from a set of senators, from the European Union, from Greenpeace, funded by Chris Larson, right? From everywhere. And basically, I said I was a fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. I work on mostly mining there, or that's what I follow and study. Just because it drew my interest and because it draws the most heat. The E is the reason why a lot of people talk about banning or fining Bitcoin miners. Of course, we've seen states actually even take action on that, like New York recently. We can come back to that. But my own vision is that not only is Bitcoin have a minimal environmental impact, like any economic activity has an environmental impact, but it's worth it because Bitcoin is worthwhile, first of all, and the impact is minimal. But also because the environmental impact of Bitcoin is radically changing over time. As Bitcoin finds, the miners find the cheapest electrical power, and they're being driven to the cheapest electrical power. We're especially seeing that now. That power tends to be hydro, which is, 1.5 cents, 2 cents a kilowatt hour. It tends to be solar in super sunny places like Morocco, where it's 1 cent a kilowatt hour. It tends to be, amazing. It tends to be wasted and stranded power around the world, which tends to be pro-social. It's not driving people's electrical utility up, but it's also helping us to monetize sources of energy, to help pay. Bitcoin helps to pay for power as well as using power. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the mainstream story. The story I talked to you about at Pacific Bitcoin is new and exciting things that people are doing with Bitcoin mining. One obvious one that people have heard of before, but it deserves repeating, is using the heat from Bitcoin miners to do things that we already do with heat, whether that's distilling whiskey or making beer, or whether that's heating greenhouses to grow food or flowers.
Or we got beef jerky. We got people doing beef jerky. They're
heating beef jerky.
You know what I mean?
Pool.
Yeah, heating their pool.
Bit jerky. Yeah.
Yeah.
it as many ways as you can think of to use low grade heat. We can use Bitcoin in all of those ways. You can think of Bitcoin as a heater that just makes, it's a resistance heater that just also produces sats along the way.
Mm-hmm.
you can think of Bitcoin as a flare stack for burning excess methane on the oil fields that just prints sats along the way. Just a very efficient and cheap flare stack. Another thing we could get into. But some of these uses of heat are blowing my mind. They are, and in particular, the one I told you about, it's a company called FlowSolve, which is created by some OG Bitcoin miners, someone who had the first major at-scale ASIC mine and who worked on some of the software for pools that is still used today, who came up with the idea of using waste heat from Bitcoin miners to give us pure water. And this is, the guy's name is Willem van Rooyen.
Yeah.
Pure water. So how could you use the heat from Bitcoin miners to make pure water? Well, you have to distill water with the heat, but distilling, Josh, you're an academic and prof. So you can probably ask questions about this process. I can't answer, but it starts with the heat from ASIC chips is not at the boiling point of water. It's lower than 100 degrees Celsius. So water will not boil when you hook up a container of water to an ASIC chip. But if you put water under a vacuum, if you put it under negative pressure, it'll boil at a lower temperature. And if you're boiling water, then it creates steam, which then condenses, and that's distillation. Then you can do that a number of times to completely purify the water. Of course, you have to run a vacuum pump to keep removing pressure. So it's additional energy input. But the process allows you not only to use that waste heat, but also because water has very interesting and specific physical properties, has a large capacity for heat. This is why the oceans play such a crucial role in the heat system of the planet. It takes a lot of energy to create the phase shift from a liquid into a gas when you boil that water. So you can use that exact point of phase shift to keep chips that are connected to that water via a custom aluminum heat sink at a very specific temperature range. So basically you find the perfect range for your chips to run temperature-wise, where you can overclock them, maximally overclock them, and then you adjust the vacuum pressure on the water so that you keep the temperature right in this perfect range for chips to operate. So it's really a perfect kind of advance in cooling systems for chips, which just so happens on the other side to create pure water out of water anywhere in the world.
So sats and water as an outcome, which nobody has enough water and nobody has enough sats. So this is like a great thing. And we've seen this on a national scale with Flint, Michigan, and some of the, let's call it, like arsenic and lead, and you know, like the DuPont scandal with Teflon and stuff like that in West Virginia decades ago. But like Africa, Nigeria, Morocco, some of these other places, they don't have clean well water. They've got, you know, they've got protozoa in their well water or whatever, and they got to boil the stuff out. Well, a vacuum pump is a fairly low tech thing. It's not like a molten salt reactor or something like that. That's going to require a lot of super gnarly stuff. And the boiling point of water is like, we all deal with that. Like everybody's put a couple pieces of wood and then like, you know, a pot and then boiled it like on camping or whatever. Like anybody
at altitude.
And so it's not that complicated, but it's sort of elegant in the same way that proof of work and some of these other things like put together became Bitcoin. So now all of a sudden Bitcoin is functioning as a sort of North Star to innovation. And people are like eyeing this thing and they know they can get sats. And it's like, can they tie anything else to it? And now there's this web of ingenuity popping up all across the world. And I just think it's so fascinating, you know?
We have to talk a little bit more about some of the applications of clean water from Bitcoin mining, because we start with things like that are maybe not the first things that come to mind, like these evaporation ponds from lithium processing and metals processing, like these really terrible kind of environmental blights. Mm-hmm. Whenever you have one of these evaporation ponds, instead of waiting months or years for liquid to evaporate out, you can purify that water and reuse it in the process, right? So a lot of our, basically look at wherever we have wastewater from an industrial process, and mm-hmm. there's a ton of that. Mm-hmm. Pharmaceutical companies using water in the production of products and in rinsing their containers, and then pharmaceutical whatever leftovers from that production, finding their way back out to the environment. No, we now have a closed loop for that water. We don't draw on the water for natural resources. So you have some process that uses a ton of water, whether it is like aluminum or whatever. Do you have to disrupt the local water system and put a major tax on that? Like, no, you have a one-time influx of water. You keep reusing the water and you take the solids out and you mm-hmm. dispose of those solids like in a landfill or whatever. So we're talking about, you know, pure water, the ability to purify water cheaply, which is what the Satoshis that you're printing do, is basically they subsidize, they're the subsidy for purification of water, is they suddenly allow, you know, local water systems to be de-stressed from the industrial processes that are happening there, right? Which is just remarkable. And like you say, there are people around the world who go to great lengths to purify their water. The ability to take that price of purification down mm-hmm. by co-locating it and integrating it with Bitcoin mining is absolutely astonishing. As Willem put it, he was like, does your consensus protocol purify water? Right? That's his challenge to proof of stake. And the applications are absolutely endless for water. Something else that Willem has shown with Margot's help, Margot Pius, my co-researcher and partner at Bitcoin Policy Institute, is that water, we know, actually absorbs carbon from the atmosphere. This is what the acidification of oceans is all about. Like the ocean's pH is changing because it's absorbing carbon from the atmosphere. Okay, so when you purify water, it has a great capacity for absorbing carbon from the air. One thing you can do with purified water, once it's purified, is run like emissions through it from a smokestack. And when you run the emissions through it, you will capture carbon in that water. Mm-hmm. Capture enough carbon in that water and then run it through the purification cycle again, and you will get that carbon out as solids and then repeat, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a way here of potentially scrubbing carbon from smokestacks. Mm-hmm. Like another thing that nobody would, not just carbon, but other kind of pollutants from smokestack, nobody would have called this, nobody would have predicted this, right? Like crazy.
But there's no other industry that has these type of effects, right? That's the whole point, which is why Bitcoin is so fantastic. And when we're talking to people in DC and we're trying to, like, I wouldn't say, like, at first it felt like we were trying to like consistently neutralize bad questions, but now it seems like we're sort of trying to give them more ammunition so that they can neutralize these arguments because they're on board and they understand it, and they want to be able to stand up like you stand up or Josh stands up or I stand up to our peers and our friends and say, hey, this is why proof of work is important. You know what I mean? And so you're hearing that proof of work is important thing kind of coming out, and you're seeing that there's maybe some Swiss cheese body armor in the proof of stake, you know, camp as a result of the trust required, which with the FTX thing and some of these other things, we've seen this blow up. So I guess the question for you, my last question, I'm going to let Josh ask some questions because I'm just trampling you.
Right, no, you're
now.
Good.
Do you think that the blowups we're seeing in the crypto space are making it easier for the Bitcoiners that are basically just John Cusacking from, you know, like holding the boombox up? For all the young listeners, there's a movie with John Cusack where it's called Say Anything. So anyways, so we're playing the same message. We've been playing the same message the whole time. And now we've got these new remixes, right? Which are basically the same song over and over again, but we're adding new beats. We're dropping these new effects in there, like this, like the water purification or heat dissipation or you know, any of these other things, because like we've been hitting with the, hey, it's this Bitcoin's the same price for Michael Saylor or, you know, Miguel from Venezuela, right? We've been hitting that type of argument for years now. The people in DC don't necessarily care about Miguel from Venezuela because they can't tax him. He's not a citizen yet, those type of things. But do you feel like it's easier now that the blowups are in huge contrast, or is the price fluctuation and the bear market type stuff hampering our sort of red carpet rollout or orange carpet rollout?
Well, you're probably in a better position to answer that than I am, but I will say my impression is it's getting harder. Unfortunately, it should be getting easier, but the FTX fallout is so indiscriminate. In particular, I just had a conversation with a miner who is in upstate New York who lost their property insurance. And the letter explaining why they lost their property insurance was like, well, we've read that the governor of New York just signed a new bill banning Bitcoin mining of a certain kind. We realize that your Bitcoin mining is not affected by this, since you're not mining, you're not introducing new mining on fossil fuels. But with the FTX implosion, we are just denying service to anybody involved in Bitcoin mining. And it was like, what does FTX have to do with this? Do you understand that that guy is a scammer and has nothing to do with this open source global permissionless protocol? And it's like, no, in the ordinary imagination, it's just like, oh, that's bad, stay away from it. It's just taboo, right? So I think it's gotten harder. It should get easier. You were at the Pacific Bitcoin Conference. Wasn't it an awesome experience? First of all, shout out to the Swan people. You put together an amazing conference. You put together an incredible conference. There was an incredible vibe there. Loving that bear market vibe. Bitcoiners know what we're about. We know who we are. We know what we stand for. And we know we've got absolutely nothing to do with the scammy surrounds of crypto. And Corey's done probably a better job than anyone on drawing that bright line and making it clear. But as much as we are trying to do that, while we get that message, I feel like we've got our work cut out for us in making that message clear to others. Kind of like ESG is an attack vector on Bitcoin. The scamminess of crypto is another attack vector on Bitcoin. It's an excuse for regulators who are looking for reasons to crack down, as Elizabeth Warren always says, crack down on Bitcoin. It's like, okay, this is why we have to crack down on Bitcoin, because of Sam Bankman-Fried and the fraud and the way that it exposed consumers to risk. So it's an excuse to go after us, and it's going to ring true with people who don't have the time to dig deep. And our job, you know, as educators, is really Bitcoin.crypto, and here's why. I don't know if you saw the recent piece in what was it, like CBS or something, NBC News, by Josh Hendrickson, my co-fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, economist, who wrote a piece basically saying, this is what we've been saying all along as Bitcoiners. This is the exact system that we oppose, this casino of garbage coins and shady offshore exchanges. This is why we Bitcoin in the first place. This perfectly resembles the financial shenanigans that set off the 2008 collapse, and the response to which was Chancellor on the Brink printed on the first Bitcoin walk, right? So we basically have our work cut out for us. This is going to be hard. We're going to have to resist other people being opportunistic about using this collapse to push, you know, like it's a crisis, right? So don't let a crisis go to waste. You can see people rushing for it. My impression anyway is that people are reaching for it, and we have to seize that narrative and say that this collapse confirms Bitcoin as a value proposition. And it illustrates what distinguishes Bitcoin from the rest, because what happened with Alameda and FTX can't happen with Bitcoin. It can't happen when you self-custody. And so we have to make that message clear.
Right. It's the exact reason why we're all here in the first place, to prevent any of that nonsense to go on. You hit on New York a little bit, but is there anywhere else in the United States where you're seeing like this geographic concentration outside of Texas? Obviously, I hear a lot about like Washington State. I hear a little bit about like Georgia. I think CleanSpark is down there. Yep. There are a few companies down there. But is there anywhere else that like would surprise people that you're seeing as far as where miners are starting to pop up?
That's a good question. Obviously, Texas gets all the attention. ERCOT is a very special grid. It's deregulated in a way that suits Bitcoin miners to monetize the special features of Bitcoin mining. And
maybe it's on an island, right?
It's an island. Yeah, it's an island. I think it's kind of silly, but it's really it's this Texan thing.
It's bizarre, but yeah.
You know, it's like, here's the situation in Texas. In West Texas, you know, 10% of the time, power is negatively priced. It's insane. Yeah. They're at the intersection of the sun and wind belt. The sun and wind belts. They have built out a lot of renewable in that area. They have very unreliable but plentiful power in West Texas, and then in East Texas they have a power shortage. The power is very expensive, and then they don't have interconnections to other grids, so they can't, for instance, take excess power from the Tennessee Valley Authority. I mean, they have minor interconnections, but not, they don't have big pipes. They don't have a big pipe between East and West Texas. That power is stranded over there. And then they don't have big pipes to other grids. So Bitcoin miners play a special role. And then they have a special marketplace for trading power in ERCOT, special regulation that allows Bitcoin miners to kind of get remunerated, get paid for providing services to that grid. So when I talk to miners in Texas, or people like, you know, Sean Connell at Lansium, he just lays out all the advantages for Texas. And it's like, we've got plentiful power here that's super cheap, negatively priced sometimes. We have an intermittent grid that really needs our help. We have a grid that sometimes has peak demands above what they standardly supply. So as Bitcoin miners, we can service this grid by shutting down when they need the power and then firing back up. We can help to stabilize this grid and we can get paid for it. So Texas is, you know, very special. But if you look at Cambridge's analysis of where Bitcoin mining is in the US, and now it's a couple months out of date, maybe this has changed, but Georgia was by far the number one state in the US, according to Cambridge, in its share of hash rate. That's not something I predicted, because like 95% of the coverage is on Texas and the other five is like New York, Pennsylvania, you know, not Georgia.
But I think though that like the question also is it creates this sort of rabbit hole effect, right? Because you have a politician that gets curious and then they're like, hey, okay, these Bitcoin guys, they want to come to my area, right?
Yeah.
And you see the Bitcoin guys are like, hey, by the way, if you guys get this, if you guys will buy this much power for this many years, if you guys can put up another power plant, we'll take a bunch of it. And then you see this kind of sort of feeding frenzy, you know, like the apple rolls down the rabbit hole and all the rabbits come out of their individual holes and kind of like nibble on it. And I think that sort of decentralization of hand raisers is unique to Bitcoin as well, because we just need power. We don't really care where it is. It could be in the middle of nowhere. It could be in the middle of a city. It could be on a river, on a waterfall, you know, next to a garbage dump, like when we had Daniel Batten talking to us about like trash, you know, methane and stuff like that. It gets back to the thing we talked about, the water thing. It's just innovation, because you can trust that Bitcoin is going to have intrinsic value to other Bitcoiners. So you know there's a 24/7 market for your Bitcoin when you mine it. As a result of that, you're willing to take a risk to mine it, you know, to buy the equipment, to power it, to,
yeah,
you know, all that stuff. And I think Texas has a identity because of the work that the Texas Bitcoiners do, you know, start to finish. Yep. You got the Lee Brasher and those guys and Christopher Callicott and those guys. And you have this whole, awesome, like, you know, and then you have all the miners, you have Marshall and all these other guys that have been just been like OG on the whole thing. And you have people like authentic Texan approach, libertarian, all that stuff to everything. And then like the governor's in on it, the senator's in on it, like Austin, Texas is there. You got like all this other stuff. And then it, so that's to me like a very, it's an easy story in Texas because you have lots of angles, right? But there's a lot of other states that have really good power production. They have like, you know, Idaho has a ton of waterfalls or water plants or, you know, hydro plants or whatever. So there's lots of other places that we could be getting more Bitcoin mining, but I think it's like that. It's this slow, like we're still in some places that the sort of drain funnel hasn't spun yet, right? There's just sort of like a lot of pressure and there's like ways for it to go down, but we haven't had like the merry-go-round of a senator, a congressman, a mayor, a governor, like all getting in on it the way you've had in some of these other states. So I think there's upside there for like maybe a hockey stick of activity in some of these other Rocky Mountain states or plain states or something like that that have similar mixes to Texas.
I think you know, I pushed Sean Connell on exactly these points, right? And Sean has kind of worked out kind of precisely the advantages and disadvantages of each locale in terms of their both the plentifulness of their energy and its pricing, but also the ability to sell services back to the grid, its regulatory status. Now that's all shiftable. If you had a Lee Bratcher and a Ted Cruz senator and whatever, you know, Greg Abbott in the right state, they could change those regulations and governing the ability to sell ancillary services and so on. But there's also there are a lot of factors. There are a lot of factors. But I agree with you that we have not had a perfect distribution. Here's what happened. Historically, this is how we need to think about how we ended up with the mix we've got. This is what happened. We had a bull run where we were at whatever, $3,000, less than that. And we rocketed up to 69,000. And ASIC production could not even come close to keeping up with that curve. So the cost of minting a Bitcoin was a tiny fraction of a Bitcoin. And the cost of power was really irrelevant as a percentage of that, because all of your input money was actually on CapEx. It was on, first of all, ASICs. The price of ASICs, what is an S19 now, is like $1,700 or something. It was 15,000 not too long ago. So you spent money on ASICs, you spent money on substations and transformers, you spent money on your facilities, and the electrical cost was a very small percentage of your business compared to, you know, your total expenditures and your total income. So that was one thing. People are just trying to get a hold of ASICs wherever they can and plug them in wherever they can. Another factor was China bans mining. They have more than 50% of the hash rate. So suddenly there's double profit because the difficulty drops almost by half. So suddenly you make twice as much Bitcoin. So the rush to plug in gets even more intense. The electrical price means even less. Third thing happens, Wall Street gets excited because they see this massive arbitrage opportunity. So they're like, how do we get in on this? Well, we have some public miners. They already have the kind of regulatory standing to borrow. They can issue bonds. They can dilute their shares. And so Wall Street just loses their shit and levers up on basically worthless fiat currency, which they can borrow at extraordinarily low rates because the Fed has said, like, the Fed has given us in the aftermath of the pandemic, low rates to keep the economy humming. We have the fiscal pipes are open. The monetary pipes are open. And so money is free. Bitcoin mining is super profitable. What happens? Mining comes to the US in a big way, and we lever up on the future because we have access to this capital. Where does it plug in? It goes to places that I remember at the time. Where are the pain points? Pain points weren't even ASICs. It was substations. It was transformers. It was experts who had expertise with power. Like, who knows stuff about grids? I remember miners like, who knows stuff about like how to hook up all, how to design airflow through a plant for optimal cooling, like hydrodynamic problems, right? Expertise of that sort. But where did they find it? Where do they solve those pain points? Where industry was dying out for the most part. So places like Appalachia and the Rust Belt, upstate New York in particular, plentiful hydropower, but upstate New York used to be a center for manufacturing. So we've got these old power plants, some of them coal converted to gas, some of them hydro. They restarted a hydro plant in upstate New York. Miners start plugging in places where there used to be buyers of power because there used to be industry and aluminum smelting, but that stuff all went overseas and particularly went to China. So this is the irony, right? Manufacturing flees to China. Then China bans mining. Miners flee to the infrastructure that the manufacturing left in the Rust Belt. And right, that's how it went down. And then what happens? Okay, miners just plugging in. They're making money hand over fist. In some towns in New York, they put pressure on local grids because they're coming in like en masse. They're
coming in hot.
Small grid. They're coming in hot. And then rates are going up. Then these miners are just basically anybody who got a hold of capital, right? They're totally some fly-by-night operations here. They don't site well. They're creating noise pollution for the neighbors in these Appalachian towns where you get massive echoes. They're creating a lot of sound. People fucking going nuts, hating it, right? Like, is it travels for miles in some of these like hollers in West Virginia or whatever? And then what happens next? Well, people are making a lot of money and they just keep doubling to Bitmain. And supply chain cannot catch up. Price still skyrocketing. Now there are coal plants that were on the verge of closing. One in Hardin, Montana. You know, some waste coal plants in Pennsylvania that are struggling. There's a coal plant in Indiana that's on the chopping block because coal is very expensive power per kilowatt. And Bitcoin miners move in there and keep them afloat because their power costs basically don't matter. Now the Sierra Club is watching. The Sierra Club and Earthwatch. And they have power experts who are like, basically on the death watch for these coal plants, waiting for them to expire. They've got their whole plans for decarbonization for the grid. And they're like, whoa, I talked to one of these Sierra Club guys and he was like, literally, we started calling up, people in the local grid system and saying, what's up? What's up? Why is this plant not closing down? Like, why did they change their plans? And it was like, oh, because a Bitcoin miner moved in. So they got their new enemy at that moment. Sierra Club found its new enemy. Sierra Club got on the horn with 70 other environmental organizations. And they wrote a letter to Congress saying where they cited some of the worst literature on Bitcoin mining and the environment that has ever existed, like notably this Mora et al. Paper from 2018. Saying that Bitcoin would boil the oceans and bring us to 2 degrees without any other source, completely debunked piece of bullshit academia. And
those are your people, Troy.
Those are my people.
Those are your people too, Professor.
It's true.
Former adjunct.
That triggers congressional hearings. Those hearings went pretty well. John Belizaire, CEO of Soluna, was on there. Who else was on there? Brian Brooks was on
Brian
there.
Brooks is great.
He gave amazing testimony there. He was on fire. But that led to, calls for the administration to look at it. That led for the Biden administration writing an executive order for basically like all branches that are affected of the executive to investigate the challenges posed by crypto across many domains, including Treasury, OFAC, but also including Office of Science and Technology Policy and looking at, and that led to a report from the OSTP that right now is being followed up by the EPA. EPA right now is meeting with groups trying to come up with standards. I haven't been a part of any of those meetings. I don't really know what's happening, but I know that people are meeting with the EPA and they are trying to devise standards. And this is where the ESG thing is going to come get us, you know? And I think that that same push into New York also led to the New York legislation, which finally just passed. I mean, that started really with one particular plant on Lake Seneca, but it was, if you look at all of the things that were filed along in support of that legislation, it was coming from Sierra Club and Earth Justice, and they saw, they projected out that trend of miners moving to New York in the most wildly bullish way. Like, the real bulls on Bitcoin's price are environmental activists, right? They all see Bitcoin's price like going to a million, like, you know, like right away, like within the halving, right? They thought, like, basically they're going to reopen like dozens of fossil plants in New York State and like totally obliterate all their climate goals. Yeah. Of course, I'm sorry, I got to wind down this rant, but I've got to tell the last part of this story because it's absolutely crucial and it was how we get where we are right now. What happens is Bitcoin, unlike Wall Street, we don't have anybody to bail us out. We deal with a real free and global 24/7 market. And the credit and liquidity extensions to this, the fiat that was breathed into the system was all loans. And those loans require payment. And unlike other industries, Bitcoin mining has a fixed supply. It's only 900 coins we're going after, guys. And the cost of a miner is ultimately going to equal the cost of producing a miner because you can enter in with your own mining machine. It's a perfect market. So what happens is very predictable, especially in the macro environment where that fiscal picture kind of turns around and tightens. The monetary picture really dramatically turns around and tightens from the Fed. Money suddenly becomes scarce. Bitcoin's price takes a dive. Then we have an energy crisis in Europe. Because of, in part, a war and, you know, taking for granted gas that's coming from Russia, no longer can take that for granted. Electricity prices spike. And Bitcoin's price falls. And at the same time, all of those machines that have been ordered from Bitmain finally start arriving and getting plugged in. And they're the latest generation S19 XPs. They're badass machines. So they run
140. So they're 40 terahashes better than the average, you know,
and the old
than the old ones, and they use the same amount of power. And that's the one thing that is always, I mean, it's like it's a perfect storm. Like with Bitcoin mining right now, it's a perfect storm. You had a vertical down of price. You had a vertical up of energy costs. You had
a hash rate.
Yeah, and hash rate's going up because the machines that are coming online are 40% more powerful. And out of desperation, people couldn't afford to unplug because they were like trying to get something, hoping to be the last man holding onto the rock effectively, right? It's made everybody that's still here stronger, which is the nature of true capitalism, which that's what you said. So the like tying it all up, it's like all these legislative things, all this other stuff, the Bitcoin cycle sort of is just, it just tumble dries the close anyways, regardless
of
whatever else is going on.
If New York, first of all, this legislation in New York, we should be clear about what it is and isn't. It bans permits for new permits or renewed permits for electrical generation facilities that are generating from fossil fuels, either gas or coal, if those plants host behind the meter mining and that mining is increasing or new. So if you are already mining behind the meter, for instance, at Greenidge, you're unaffected. If you are mining on grid mix, as far as I can tell, just plugging in at like a local business, you're unaffected. The only business that would be affected by this legislation would be new mining operations that didn't exist or expanding miner operations that are operating behind meter on fossil power generation. So the actual scope of the law is pretty narrow. And as my partner at BPI, Margo Paez, discovered in writing her own report on the subject, the authority that issues these permits could already have denied them in exactly those same circumstances under existing law. So this, first of all, this law is purely symbolic. While it is actually affecting minors in the region, it's affecting them through the social symbolic signaling of the law more than the actual substance of the law.
It's a shot to the bow that says, you're not welcome
here. Shot across the bow. Exactly.
Get
out. And it was based on a particular snapshot of the market in Bitcoin mining at one particular amazing moment where we had a 20x bull run paired with China shutting down, paired with an incredibly loose monetary policy,
right,
paired with fiscal, sluice open, like a very, very special moment. They took that snapshot, they generalized it, and they were like, yeah, we're basically facing an onslaught of Bitcoin miners coming in, disrupting local power markets and eating up, keeping fossil alive. None of that would have happened, both because they had the laws in place, but also because, as you say, CJ, it already, the Bitcoin market took care of that. It drove down the margins. The margins now on mining are extremely thin. And when you were talking about like the miners like finding their way and the politicians together, like miners finding their way to their like ideal habitat.
Yes.
Yeah. That requires like agitation, right? That's not just going to happen on its own, because you're going to keep sort of mining where you are because it's easy and you've already put roots down there. This agitation is getting your ass handed to you by the market, which is exactly what has happened.
Yeah.
The miners have,
it's called a crash course, right? This is what learning is, and the friction that we learn. I mean, this is when we explain Bitcoin, because I don't have a philosophy degree or anything like that, but I like to look at the big picture, and I mean big picture like on a celestial sense, right? So you look at like the effects of things, right? Everything is tied together. Everything is related. So like you stretch too far in one way, it's elastic. It's going to get pulled back down because there's hype cycles, there's supply chain cycles, there's price cycles, there's all these other things happening at the same time. And, you know, what happened is going to happen again, because it's already happened before, right? There's these things that have happened. There's been bear markets in Bitcoin. Yep. You know, Josh and I have talked to a lot of our guests about the previous bear cycles and like what's parallel, what's similar, and how does this, you know, relate to other asset classes or other assets or other times in market, other markets. But the way I look at it, and I think this is so interesting because you brought it up, right? The agitation. So I like, when I have this conversation with people, I like to use the word friction, right? When you experience friction on your journey forward in life, you know, your skin thickens up. The resistance training builds your muscles, right? The sort of pattern recognition forces you to run away from certain predators, right? So we've evolved as humans to kind of encounter things head on, take a huge lump to the face or the groin, and then like back up and be like, okay, I need to do this. I still want to get there, but I don't think I can go down that hallway anymore. You know what I mean? It's like in Step Brothers when they get beat up by the little kids and they're like, okay, what was your lesson? And we're not going to go that way anymore. We're not going to take the shortcut. And it's like, okay, like there is no shortcut in mining. That's it. It's a real, it's a roach industry. It's survival. It's not Lambos, you know, and that's the ish though, like the free lending that was out there for everybody. I mean, I still get emails, they're like, hey, do you want to expand your mining operation? I'm like, I'm not taking a fucking loan, because like that's the last thing I need to do is add bankruptcy proceedings to like the thin margins, you know, that I have right now. I don't need the lawyer costs to go through that, you know. I think that's something that people didn't have access to before, because like you said, Wall Street didn't give a shit about Bitcoin mining. It wasn't a multi-billion dollar industry. There weren't billion dollar companies in Bitcoin mining 5 years ago, right? So now that there are, the stakes are higher, and higher stakes equal higher pain on the river. You know what I mean? Like the last card drops and it's like, ooh, clean out. You know what I mean? And it's like, hey, you just lost at the final table. Hey, congrats for getting there. You know what I mean? But it's like the people that don't manage their Bitcoin and their cash and their operation like a real company, like all real companies have to do, if they don't manage their risk, they get wrecked. And that's the thing that like, it's hard when you just enter the thing. And like you said, going from mining at 3,000 to mining at 30,000. And then it's like, hey, dude, as long as power is less than 20 cents, we're profitable. It's like, to 20 cents, you could mine like S19s at home. You know what I mean? exactly. But now it's down to the point where, like, if you're mining and your cost is over 5 or 6 cents, you're probably not going to make it, you know? So
yeah,
that's a monster extreme. And I think, you know, the weird thing is Bitcoiners just get tougher, you know, and so the people that survive will end up figuring out better structures to their mining businesses. I think that's the moral of the story, I guess, as a result.
I love all of that. I think it's actually kind of inspiring to watch this process at work. It's collectively making us smarter and stronger each time we go through a cycle, and people get burned in different ways. We learn different lessons and we come away from it better. And I know some people who have been hurt in this cycle, you know, miners, and who are suffering. And I don't mean to diminish what they're going through. It sucks, right? It does suck. But thinking as a Bitcoiner, it's like, okay, how much better is this than proof of stake? And Joe Lubin and Vitalik just kind of sitting there on their 70% pre-mine, effortlessly making money again and again, right? They don't have any risk in Ethereum terms to speak of.
Even better than that, they were the first ones to deny withdrawals when they locked everything in ETH 2.0. That's the best part. They were the first ones to rug everybody, you know?
I mean, what they're doing is essentially like HEX, where you lock up your stake for in a long period of time, and that reduces liquidity. A lot of I would not be surprised to see big pumps in ETH price because the
stake. Sure, that's going to be the headline now. The headline's going to be Bitcoin Maxi just compared ETH to HEX. That's going to be
Yeah, it is like HEX, and it's I mean, Richard
Hart
is
like, by the way, you're not
wrong. He's like an evil genius, right? Like, he is a genius in a certain way. He's very smart. And it's like, it's even smarter with ETH, because you know that Richard Hart is just scheming for how to be as scammy as possible and do the scam well, but ETH pretends to be something else. But locking up people's stake for an indefinite period is an amazing pumponomics move. You've taken so much liquidity off the market that if some institutional players come in a big way, there isn't enough supply to meet it, because the supply is freaking locked up in staking. Right.
Right.
So it's like, oh, nice job. Nice job. I mean, it's clever, but what an unjust system. And as painful as this whole, like, I've told this whole story, and thanks for letting me rant it all out. And you wrapped it up beautifully, CJ. Like, this is a system I believe in. It's bloody. People get hurt. It rewards efficiency. It ruthlessly punishes inefficiency. It ruthlessly punishes leverage. It redistributes wealth in accordance with how well you manage it. Mm-hmm. And that system up against a system where you almost effortlessly and almost without any risk can earn return just for, like, letting people tread on your property, basically. You mm-hmm. own some of the property, they want to cross it, you charge them a fee. That's rent seeking, right? Mm-hmm. I fundamentally reject that model and fundamentally embrace the model of nature cleansing itself that we have in Bitcoin. That aligns with my values. It's more of the world I want to live in. Yeah. And so, I'll take the pain in order to be in that system.
Because there's purity in that, right? It's a reality check. And I think when people don't want to live by the laws of the universe or the laws of physics or, like, the laws of, you know, good and evil or whatever, they want to make their own rules nonstop.
They want to make their own perpetual motion machine.
Yeah, that's
Vitalik says this explicitly, right? He said the problem with Bitcoin is it's bound by the laws of physics, because it's the laws of physics that govern mining. And we can engineer better laws as the developers for Ethereum. And so he's admitting, in some ways, it's like he's just admitting the whole value proposition of Bitcoin. It's like, yeah, Bitcoin is valuable precisely because we cannot beat physics. We cannot screw with physics. That's the point.
Right. And it allows us to live a real life because we're not trying to play God and reinvent physics, right? That's the thing that's important to me. And I think that's where going back to the Odell thing, constantly staying humble, stacking sats, staying humble. Like it's hard to do.
It is hard
to stay humble, right? It's easy to do things, but I do think that, you know, this was great for a lot of reasons, because number one, you do need to rant to make your points, because you do have big, you pile on a lot of stuff, you know, to yourself. You put it on, you put on the jacket, the sweater, the gloves, the beanie, everything. Like you wear it all, right? And you charge into the room and people are like taking shots at you or whatever. You come from a great place, you know, and I think your intentions are fantastic. I think that, you know, you and I both suffer from, like, I'll call it broad vision, where we think of something and we say, oh, let's connect it to everything, right? Let's connect all these dots together. That's why I like to talk about Bitcoin as an octopus, because it's got eight arms that can ensnare you.
It does.
You know? And I think the best thing that can happen is for you to keep living the life that you are living, which is to say that, hey, I'm going to be out there with my vision. I'm going to be out there with my comments. I'm going to be open to having good natured, or at least maybe not even good natured, but at least like philosophically honest battles. If you want to battle on something, let's agree to the terms and let's go at it in good faith. So as long as there's good faith, that's the only thing someone like you really requires, because you have thick enough skin. It's kind of like I would go pitch and, you know, hostile territories like Yankee Stadium, and like I would get the shit boot out of me, right? And I'm like, listen, boo me all you want. If you throw batteries at me, we're gonna have a problem. But like, if you want to just boo me, that's fine. Like I can handle that, because I'm here to compete with those guys on the other team, not fight people in the stands. You know, I'm not gonna go run our test and go punch dudes in the first row. And I think that's the thing that Bitcoiners like yourself that have been in it a long time, you can do that. You have the thickness of your skin that you can absorb the shit posts and stuff like that, because you're going with momentum in a good direction. So we need that in Bitcoin. And you and I might be on slightly different areas and trying to find fits, you know, where these things work together. And that's kind of where it's like the Rubik's Cube, where we're trying to sort of solve things with our own sort of monkey brains and trying to just keep twisting until things line up. But Bitcoin is a clarifier, a purifier. It's pain. It's you know, all these things, and those are all good, because those are all real, and that's what we need. And I think then we can, and it's to me, it's opening people's eyes up a lot to what reality is and how bad things are in other places that don't have property rights, don't have financial freedom, don't have sovereignty and privacy and some of these other things that we kind of take for granted, maybe because we're Bitcoiners. Or, you know, because we're Americans or whatever else. But that's where I think, you know, we're starting to see, I see this really big, like, we're both, you know, we have freedom seekers and Bitcoiners, and we're like running over the side of the hill, and we're dealing with that last little bit of pain and lactic acid that's, you know, like from charging for so long. But the reward is going to be at the top of that. And I think we're seeing, you know, seeing the pain that other people experience, and they're going to topple and twist their ankle and fall down. And we just have to keep going, right? Those of us that can keep going have to keep going.
Troy, I'm going to first, let me thank you. I'll give you a last word in a second, but thank you for being so generous with your time. The good people can follow you at, on Twitter, the Tro Crow, no W, no, the TROCRO, right?
Yes.
Anything you want to leave us with?
No, just, you know, thank you for having me, and CJ, I appreciate the kind words, and I want to return them. I like the conversations we've had in person and online, and I realize that we're not aligned on everything, and wherever we aren't, I'm like, okay, what does this guy know that I don't know? And you know, Bitcoin has really helped me actually open my mind. Like, I thought I was open-minded, but I talked to a narrow range of people. I didn't think I talked to a narrow range of people, but I did. And I didn't realize that until being in Bitcoin, really, how narrow the range was. And I appreciate it. I think the way we get over that hill, you know, is more of us doing the same. I mean, I've been so thrilled to see people stepping up, like my colleague at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, Josh Hendrickson, stepping up recently to really articulate why this FTX debacle illustrates the value case of Bitcoin, or this pleb, Cosmo Crickster, who wrote this incredible letter to the ECB yesterday. Cosmo is actually a poet by profession. And this letter, if you haven't read it, oh, it's freaking amazing. I want to frame the thing and put it on my wall, telling the ECB why they're wrong. I mean, the more of us who step up with different voices, with different perspectives, if we can disagree in a way that is open-minded and civil, then like we can collectively hammer a lot of different audiences. Like I realize, like this poet, he's got a different audience than mine. Mm-hmm. And you know, and so do the economists. Like they tap into a different audience than I do. And so does this professional baseball player I'm talking to, right? You have a different, totally different, you connect with different people than I do. That's how we win. We win by each one of us sort of internalizing and thinking through Bitcoin and what it could do, what it's already doing, and communicating that to the people that we connect with, right? And then for those of us who are not into communication, just building shit, the engineers, the capitalists, like allocating as a community, it's just inspiring and awesome to see us move forward on so many dimensions. It's kind of like central planning fails, but central planning a movement also fails. We are a decentralized movement top to bottom. And no individual person could foresee or direct traffic in a way that's actually happening. I am optimistic and hopeful that we'll get, I like your metaphor, you know, that the people who need Bitcoin and the people who have it will find each other at the top of the hill, both of them engaged in a struggle. And sorry, Josh, I didn't get to engage with you so much.
No, that's okay.
TJ, but thank you so much for having me on. Thanks for sharing your time with me. I know your time is very valuable as well.
We'll leave it there and CJ can take us out.
As with every episode, we are not providing financial advice, so make sure that you are checking with yourself, your spouse, and everybody for what you need to be doing with your money. We do believe in Bitcoin, and we will see you on the internet. Feel free to jump in our DMs or reply guy us, and we will be ready for all of it. And we wish you luck out there on the Bitcoin battlefield.